steps onto the ice, not trusting the thickness or stability of it. I pursue him, but remain close to shore. He edges out to the center of the lake.
I have no regrets or sorrow.
He throws out his wings and inhales the dark.
Through Kerr, all will be free.
Something hits the ice under my feet. I jolt and nearly slip and fall. Craggy rifts spear across the lake. I scramble back to land. Shadows dart under the breaking surface. Udug tarries on the lake, leering with snaggy teeth. Great fissures tear open the frozen sheet to the water below. Figures jump out in an explosion. I shield myself against raining shards of ice. A trio of demons wades out of the waters of the craterous lake. The largest demon's physique bulges of rocks. His giant frame is hard-packed and rigid as a mountain. His mouth is a slash, a grimace, and his eye sockets are crevices of nothing, like caverns. The demon lumbers closer, the ground trembling with each step. The second biggest demon has a sinuous face like a dragon cobra, her scaly skin reminding me of a jungle crocodile's. A thick, rough tail drags behind her as long as she is tall. Her three-forked tongue flicks in the air. Its trio of sharp tips resemble an Urumi, an advanced warrior weapon with whip-like blades. The demon third in line comes ashore chomping on a snow trout. Her razor teeth rip through the fish's flesh and bone. She bears resemblance to her aquatic prey. Glassy, circular eyes, gills down her neck, fin-like hands and feet, and iridescent scales. She swallows the trout's head whole in one bite. Good gods, the lake is the gate to the void. Udug floats over the broken ice to shore and points at the rock man.
Meet Asag,
then the crocodile snake.
Edimu.
Lastly, fish eyes.
Lilu.
I push my powers into my hand, illuminating my quivering fingers, and carefully backtrack to the shadowed woods. Coming alone was a noble thought when I was up against a solitary demon. Confronting four demons by myself is lunacy. Udug's siblings glare at the night sky.
The moon is too bright,
Edimu hisses, flicking her multi-forked tongue.
The celestial powers are failing,
Udug assures her. Out of spite, Asag heaves a stone the size of my head at the moon, as though to knock it from its velvet curtain. His throw falls short, and he grumbles. I am less than 10 paces from the cover of the forest when Edimu tastes the air with her tongues.
What's this?
She asks. Lilu sniffs, her neck gills flaring like nostrils. Her fish eyes roam to me.
It smells like ass. Only is rotten.
She's an offspring of Unleal,
Udug explains.
Kor wants her preserved.
Asag answers, his voice a cavernous rumble.
You were supposed to bleed the light out of her before Master arrives.
Blue flames ignite in Udug's hands.
We have time.
Asag picks up a hefty rock along the shore and hurls it at me. I leap out of its way and blast a heat wave at him. It feels good to have my abilities back. My fire strikes his chest and disperses. He sustains a small scorch mark. I rise from my crouch. Uh-oh. Edimu unrolls her long tongues and flicks the air between us like a whip. A powerful gust throws me backward into the trees. I hit a log, hard. When I look up, unblinking fish eyes stare down at me. Lilu grabs me with slimy hands. My veins lurch, tangling and knotting painfully.
I'll leech the rotten light out of you,
Lilu says, her voice a watery gurgle. I buck in agony as she coaxes out my blood. Droplets bead from my pores, draining my strength. I suffered this once. Never again. I scorch my fire at her through her scaly skin. Lilu shrieks and scuffles away. I lob another heat wave after her, but Alsag blocks it with a huge rock. Udug flies into me, slamming me into the ground. I try to burn the demon with my hands, but my fire does not harm him.
I will cleanse you of your conscience, dear sister.
He starts to pour his cold fire powers into me, but mighty gusts rip him off. Lying on my back, I clutch at the pain ebbing from my chest. Two Lestarian navy vessels hover above, their multiplied ivory sails brimming in the high winds. I urge my mind to comprehend what I am seeing. The sea ship is flying. Udug and his demon siblings retreat to the lake shore. The vessels land near the road, and armed sailors shimmy down rope ladders. Several run to meet me. Devin and Ashwin lead the charge, Natasha and Yatin after them. Brock and Jemmy take up the rear. What in the skies? Captain Locke is a passenger of one of the vessels, lowering itself to the ground. His crew of raiders, Opal, and Lestarian sailors navigates the navy ship, suspending it on their wings. Udug and his demon siblings guard the lake, surveying the array of forces. They will not surrender their post unless we compel them. You brought the raiders? I ask my friends, watching the ships land. Devin looks me over with a troubled frown. I have stopped bleeding from every pore, but I must look a mess. He, however, is imposing in the strict lines of his navy blue general's jacket.
We needed Galer, so His Majesty bought their loyalty. Temporarily, Ashwin adds.
Admiral Rimba joins us, leading his trident-wielding men. Captain Locke and his raiders, a mishmash of rogue Bootas, also boost our ranks. Kalinda? What are those hideous things? Natasha asks, as though the demon's unsightliness were the worst side effect of their release. They're Udug's kin here to guard the gate. The lake, I emphasize, and then explain what they are in haste. We have to vanquish them before the celestial lights go out. Devin eyes the failing moon.
Take your positions.
And then to Ashwin.
Your Majesty, stay at my right.
Ashwin grips his sword too low on the hilt. He has little practice or skill with Akanda. The world has never been drearier, but my loved ones remind me the gods are on our side. Devin raises his sword.
All forward!
We have marched halfway to the lakeshore when visibility reduces to graininess and our enemies wane to murky shadows. The ground shakes, an ongoing quake that rattles my knees, and the center of the lake boils. Udug and his siblings howl gleefully at the darkening sky. The lake simmers faster, sending rippling waves that spill onto the shore. I grip the sleeve of Devin's wool jacket, fastening us together as the moon and stars go under, drowned by the evernight.
32. Devin. My breath snags on nettles of terror. Every soldier experiences setbacks in battle, but never have I felt more vulnerable. Surrounded by my family, I have more to lose than my life. I could lose the people who make my life worth living. Udug's and his siblings' jubilant screeches abruptly stop. Splashing fills the darkness, and then deep, resonant thuds vibrate up from the ground. Something has risen out of the water. And it is big.
Gods, Devin.
Kali strangles my forearm, but I am grateful for our connection. More whispers of shock and horror resound around us in the impenetrable dark.
What's out there?
Natasha whispers. Booms approach our front line. The trembling ground knocks Kali and me back a step.
I don't think you want to know,
replies Opal. Her amplified hearing can detect what is coming our way through the obsidian night. Brock tosses a heat wave at the forest across the way. His fire ignites the stubby alpine evergreens and strips back the darkness. The biggest dragon mankind has ever beheld towers over us. Taller than what was once the north tower of the temple, the dragon's blue-black serpentine body glistens and drips icy water. His front feet and talons curl into the wet lakeshore. He drags his thick shape out of the water and roars, a gut-shaking bellow. Kali covers her arms, and I shrink down in my general's jacket. The dragon twists his neck, turning his long snout with pointed, wiry whiskers away from the firelight. Kali lowers her hands and whispers, I saw this war once in a mural in Ki's ancient underground temple. Kur was battling an army of men in the mountaintops. How did it look for us? I ask.
He burned the army to ashy silhouettes with his fiery breath.
Brock's fire gradually extinguishes. The snowy trees are poor kindling. So Opal feeds the flames with her winds. Fire brightens the area once more. Kur hisses and narrows his gold eyes at the blaze.
I do not like the light.
His guttural voice rumbles through me. I lock down my courage before it wriggles away. Kur! Kali shouts. The dragon turns his head toward our troops. Return to the void and take your underlings with you!
Do you know what happened to the last mortal who threatened the first ever dragon?
His talons claw ditches into the wet dirt.
I disemboweled him, splattered his entrails all over his friends, and picked my teeth with his spine.
The god of demons leans down so we can see our reflections in his gold eye.
I existed before these mountains were a pile of pebbles, before mankind was a grouping of stars Anu pilfered from the heavens for his gain. I am born of Tiamat, the saltwater goddess, filled with fiery venom to avenge her and destroy all who worship her traitorous son Anu.
Anu left this world to mankind and Bhutas, Ashwin calls out. Kur blinks at him.
You reek of fear, boy.
Ashwin raises his sword. Of all the times he could exhibit courage, this is not it. I edge in front of him, garnering Kur's notice. He sniffs the air, and his throaty voice hardens.
You smell of sacrifice. Your saccharine scent curdles my stomach.
Kur sniffs again, and his glowing eye focuses on Kali.
You are mine, and another,
he says of Brock.
Why do you stand with weaklings, children of the Evernight?
My fate is my own, Kali says, boosting her chin. Brock points to Udug and the other demons.
And who wants to look like them?
The demon Kur hisses a breath that smells of decaying bodies.
I could drag you into the void and teach you the way of the shadows.
Kali hoists her dagger to him, gripping it crosswise in front of her, and Brock readies his axes.
No. Then you are finished.
Kur lifts his massive head, stretching until his whole height looms over us. Smoke billows from his nostrils.
General, Admiral Rimba says, your order?
Hold to the plan. Keep your ranks tight and push them back toward the gate.
Delightful.
Brock widens his stance and grips his axes. Kur crooks one of his talons, and his underlings charge. The demons run at us, but Kur crouches like a snow leopard, opens his jaw wide, and blows a ribbon of fire at our ranks. I dive away from the heat, and Kali goes the opposite direction. She lands with Brock on the other side of the inferno. Ashwin lies beside me, his shirt on fire. He bats at it helplessly. I strip off my jacket and use it to beat out the flames. Ashwin droops in relief.
Thank you. Don't thank me yet.
I haul him up. Across the way, Kali dashes into the fray, headed for Kur. I try to keep sight of her, but she disappears behind a line of aquifers, who draw water from the lake and shoot it at Lilu. The fish-like demon duels back, spraying her own streams of frigid water at them. Yatin and Natesha intercept Edimu, the reptilian one, and Princess Jemmy and Captain Locke go after the lumbering rock demon Asag. Suddenly, I see Opal, opposing Udug on her own. Her brother's killer has trapped her against a high embankment over the ice-riddled lake. I run to help her, dragging Ashwin after me, and push him behind a boulder. Stay here! Opal is backed over the edge of the embankment, her heels meeting the drop-off. Udug gathers blue fire in his clawed hands. I sprint, Kanda raised over my shoulder, and slice through his wing. Udug yowls high and loud. Opal slides between his legs and jams her machete up through his thin-skinned belly. Black sludge oozes out. He retaliates with a burning sphere of cold fire, blasting her. She wrenches back and crumples. Udug flies off with one fully functioning wing, cradling his injury. The stench of charred flesh and seared muscle accosts me as I lean over the Galer. Burns cover more than half of her body. Her skin completely gone along one arm and part of her neck. I hold her unwounded hand. Her return grip loosens. Her breath's wrenching gasps. Her suffering drags up my sorrow over Rowan's death. Once again, I can do nothing. Opal, I scratch out. I'm sorry. Her pained whimpers lessen, and her focus turns inward with startling intensity. The battlefield drifts off to another world.
I can hear them calling.
Who?
My mother and Rohan. They're waiting for me.
I press her hand over my heart. You should go to them.
Yes.
Opal's torso jolts wildly. One final protest of her physical anguish, and her gaze empties of life. My chin drops to my chest. Anu, let her family receive her. I grant myself a moment of grief, and let her go. The battle continues at my back, but my hearing still rings with Opal's final breaths. I will not leave her out in the open for our enemies to revel over. I carry her to Ashwin and set her behind the boulder. He lays my jacket over her middle, covering her wound. Flashing flames draw my attention to the front line. Kali and Brock exchange fire blasts with Kur. The first ever dragon will wear them out. Buta powers are limited. His are eternal. A rock crashes into our boulder. I crouch over Ashwin as rubble pelts our backs. Asag pummels us with more splintering rocks. The boulder shielding us cracks from his repeated hits. Can you swim? I ask Ashwin.
Yes, why?
I grab a stone and toss it at Asag. It pings off the brute's chest. He extends his huge chest and growls.
I don't think he likes that, Ashwin says. Run for the lake!
We take off for the shore. I stay right behind the prince as a buffer between him and the demon. We pull ahead of the lumbering Asag, and I am knocked off my feet by a flying rock. I fall forward, my bones jarring, and roll onto my back. Asag stomps on my chest and leaves his foot there. Something snaps inside me and releases pain. My spine presses into the ground and seals off my breath. Ashwin runs into my side vision and swings his kanda at Asag. The blade clangs against the rock giant. Asag shoves the prince away, then removes his foot from my chest only to aim his next stomp at my head. A hand shoots through the demon's thick middle. Princess Jemmy yanks out a fistful of rocks. Asag tips backward in a slow-motion fall. Jemmy sweeps him up in a wave of summoned dirt and heaves him into the lake. He smacks the surface and sinks underwater.
So, that's how you vanquish a demon.
Princess Jemmy pants, hands on her hips.
Evidently, I croak, clutching my torso.
Asag broke at least one of my ribs. Jemmy lifts Ashwin and hangs on to him. He will be safe with her. We need to vanquish three more demons.
and I am not losing another soldier tonight. Stay together, I tell them as I fetch my sword and take off for the main battleground.
33. Kalinda. Kor will not be moved. No matter where Brock and I throw our fire, the demon god steps farther from the lake. The Evernight will prevail if he gains more ground. I feel it in my gut. Brock discharges another heat wave at the serpentine dragon, his unique orangey flame weaker than his last. Our powers do not penetrate Kor's scaly shell. We will soon lose the convenience of our soul fire with this useless strategy. Nature fire feeds off the trees, lighting the battlefield. Serpents dance in the flames, swirling and twirling happily. Their flickering eyes trail me, worshipful and adoring in our mutual love of the light. I stretch my fingers to them. My friends, I have missed you. Fiery tendrils shoot out and encircle my body, hot and heady. I call them to action. Create me a helpmate. The nature fire hisses, and more flames zip from the wildfire. They whirl and fasten together, combining ferocity. A monster forms between Kor and me, a serpentine beast that rises to the demon god's great height. The nature fire mimics the first ever dragon's proportions and builds a blazing dragon of his girth and stature with short legs, a sleek, proud neck, and a snappish snout. The fire dragon glows every color of Burner's powers, vivid white, sun yellow, scarlet, and inside the sweltering beast flickers a heart of sapphire. I marvel at how rapidly and seamlessly the nature fire melds into a tangible creature of one mind and purpose, to obey my command. Brock lists back on his heels.
When did you learn to... Guard my flank!
My dragon lowers, and I mount it, absorbing the heat without suffering any injury. For I am fire, and fire is me. Riding atop the immense dragon, I am eye to eye with Kor. His gaze flashes.
You think you can use fire against me? I am born of fire and venom.
I lean into my dragon, preparing to ride. I am born of the stars, and I will see them shine again. Push him to the lake. Let's take back the heavens. My fire dragon drives its head into Kor's chest and muscles him back. Kor sidesteps and breathes flames. I duck behind my mount's head. The column blows past me, but his venomous fire rips small holes through my dragon. Brock throws heat waves at Kor's front feet. He bats Brock away with his talons, flinging him into the dark. Fly! My dragon launches into the sky. Kor chases us with a blast of white-blue cold fire. We evade him by flying higher. Kor lunges at my dragon's neck, clamps down with his jaws, and throws us to the ground. Everything jostles and trembles as we roll. I struggle to hang on until we are upright again. My dragon crouches, the path we rolled over scorched. Kor ejects more cold fire at us, tearing new gaps in my dragon. The solidity of the flames beneath me begins to disperse. As Kor gathers a finishing blast, an astounding sight appears. Elephants? In the Alpanas? Green-clad Janardanian warriors ride them, boasting their green and white dragon cobra flag. Mathura and Chit ride together atop an elephant with ivory tusks. The herd stampedes onto the battleground. Land barges, large slabs of stone over rock wheels roll to a halt. More elephant warriors charge off the barges into the front line, machetes raised. They shake the ground, loosing the dirt at Kor's feet and hauling him toward the gate. Kor's tail crests the cold water. He vents a gut-rolling roar and blows fire at the forward row of elephant warriors. I watch in horror as his venomous cold fire consumes rider and beast alike. I hunch into my mount, fury boiling through me. Get him. We take off. Kor releases a stream of flames. We swerve, but it hits the center of my dragon. The solid fire beneath me dissolves to spindles of smoke and steam. The world washes to red, orange, yellow, blue. I am falling. Fire tunnels around me in a whirlwind of shrieks and snaps. I smack into the ground, my fire dragon fading above me just like the stars. The quakes continue with the stampeding elephants, the tremblers relentless. They force Udug and his sister demons to the lake, but Kor is too big and heavy for tremors to topple him. The first ever dragon slams his front claw over me, locking me down. He pushes one pointed talon into my thigh. Something pops and tears. He digs in farther, puncturing through skin, meat, bone. My ears echo with screams. Only until I find my breath do I realize I am the one screaming. Trembles carry off from the elephant warriors, distant booms in the ground. Kor's snout comes over me. One breath, and he will burn me to a heap of ash.
It's not too late to send you to the void, my child. You will never suffer pain or regret again.
I push up against his talons. Nothing but venom burns within him to parch, cold and unyielding. Falling back on my powers, I send my scorching soul fire into him. Kor's brimstone breath cascades over me.
Your powers are insignificant, but another power dwells within you that can never fade. Come into the Evernight.
He squeezes, crushing my sides. His whiskers brush over my face, stinging like tentacles.
I can free you from your weak, mortal chains. I can make you magnificent.
I reply through gritted teeth. I already am. Screeches fill the mountaintop, a clarion call to fight. A flock of Mahati falcons, the birds of prey larger than any I have seen, dive at Kor, tearing furiously at the demon. He rears up, wrenching his claw out of my limb and releasing me from his clutches. I roll to my side, gasping and cradling my bleeding leg. Tinley leads a unit of Paljorian warriors who ride the birds. As natural enemies to serpents, the Mahatis fight on instinct. They circle Kor's crown in expert formation. Their talons scratch and sharp beaks peck at his scaly hide. Inda and Pons ride in tandem upon a falcon with burgundy feathers and release crossbow bolts into Kor's breast. He chases the circling flock and breathes fire. They scatter, fast and agile, but he strikes one falcon, and it plummets into the lake.
Kali!
Devon drops to his knees beside me. Devon, my leg! He strips off his tunic and ties it around my thigh.
It's all right. Don't think of it. You can outlast this.
I groan, a guttural wrench of pain as he finishes tying the cloth. His white tunic is quickly stained crimson. The Mahati flock's harassment drives Kor into the lake up to his hind legs, but he knocks another two falcons from the sky with his venomous fire. A sudden wind stirs, and in the distance, lit by lanterns, a fleet of Paljorian airships speeds into view. Chief Naresh directs his crew at the bow of the lead ship. The Galers on board summon the northern wind and propel gusts at Udug and his sisters. The ground vibrates around Devon and me, stones hopping and jumping. White caps cover the surface of the lake, whipped into a frenzy by the wind. Aquifiers stake their tridents through Lilu. She flies back into the waves and they smother her. A trembler traps Idimu's flicking tongue with a boulder, and a landslide pitches her into the lake. Udug, wounded, shoots blue fire at elephant warriors. Tinley dives at him with char. The falcon plucks him up, her talons ripping through his wings. Udug flails, but the falcon lowers to the water and drops him in. A swell sweeps him under. We're winning. We're going to resurrect the morning. Anu is watching over us from Ikor on high. He will not let us fail. The falcon warriors combating Kor take their leave to give room for the airships. Kor sends fire at the sky, striking one. The patchwork of sails ignites. The ship tips, the flames overtaking it, and careens into the land. The other Paljorian airships harness the northern wind and converge on the demon dragon. Their gusts slide Devon and me into the knee-high frigid water. Devon stabs his sword through the cloth of my tunic, embedding the blade in the lakeshore and anchoring me to it. He grips the hilt, and I hold on to him. The airships fly nearer, intensifying their winds. The Lestarian navy pushes Kor with waves, adding to the impetus. The onslaught impels him farther into the choppy water. Devon's hand slips. I catch his wrist before he flies away. I hang on to the sword, but his wet grip slides from mine. He spins off into the lake. No! I lose sight of him, foam and dirt in my eyes. He reappears, swimming helplessly against the powerful currents and crosswinds. Someone help him! Inda and Ponza's Mahati dives, claws outstretched to pluck Devon up, but the gales knock them back and they pinwheel out of range. Kor sinks up to his breast. Deafening winds howl at me. My tunic rips free from the sword, but my hand holds me in place. Behind me, the lakeshore has been cleared for this attack. Even the aquifers conduct the waves from afar. I am the closest person to Devon. I inhale a deep breath and let go. Gusts pitch me across the water. I land among the chunks of ice up to my neck in freezing waves. The cold bites, the water like teeth dragging me to Kor. Devon is caught in a tide pool near him, dipping in and out of sight. A surge pushes me under. Another heaves me up and whirls me about. Kor's claws rake at the air. Our forces are sending all they have at him, but his head remains above water. He needs a reason to go under. I ride an incoming swell to him and latch on to his scaly side. With one hand, I reach inside him and pull, parching him. His venom powers flow into my burning palm. My fingers blister and boil. My skin melts, but I hold fast. I can stand his cold fire. I can embrace the night. Kor tries shaking me free. I hold on and bring the Evernight into my bones. Agony screams up my arm, begging for me to stop. The pain spreads everywhere, excruciating to the point of near blindness. Unable to draw in any more, I let go, and a white cap drags me from him. My fingers continue to shrivel, eaten by the cold venom I welcomed inside me. Kor! I bellow. He lowers his head to me, and I throw the cold fire I parched back at him. The sapphire flames burn across his snout and ignite his whiskers. He tosses his head to extinguish them, but the venomous fire blazes across scales, indiscriminate in its destruction. A wave pushes me under and up again, Kor's eye level. He lowers his snout to the water to put out the flames. I reach for the last of the cold fire within me and send the blue-white flames at his eye. He roars and thrashes as it burns and burns. Kali! Devon calls. He is trapped in Kor's wake. Our gazes connect, both rife with terror. Kor is still on fire. Unable to withstand the pain, the demon god submerges to extinguish the flames. The strength of his descent whips up a massive tow of cross-currents. A maelstrom spins me around its outer radius. Closer to the center of the violent whirlpool, Devon is sucked under. No! I dive for him. Shadows writhe below, grasping and pulling like hooks. I push my powers into my uninjured hand, but the muted glow does not reveal Devon or Kor. The blackness is all-consuming. My lungs pang for air. But the darkness tugs at me, tying itself to my ankles like millstones. I descend into the cold nothing, closer to the gate. A sudden upsurge drills into my side. The current launches me into the air. I gasp, sputtering, as I am wrenched on a wave across the surface to shore. I land on the wet rocks, wilted and panting. Cold chatters my teeth. My leg bleeds freely, lying limp and frozen before me. My injured hand, my drawing hand, is so mangled it is unrecognizable. Its flesh has been nearly eaten away, the remnants of the fiery venom still burning. I cradle my hand close and scan the waves between the chunks of ice for Devon. Ashwin races up to me in the dying winds. Kali, where's Devon? I concentrate, pushing against my draining consciousness. Kor took him? Ashwin considers the roiling lake, his jaw hard set. He went under.
I'll find him, Kalinda.
Ashwin tears off his jacket, splashes in, and dives underwater. Just as he goes, Natasha and Yotin reach my side. She blanches at my disfigured hand and bloody thigh and calls for Inda. The quivers within me rise to uncontrollable quakes.
Where did the prince go, Kalinda?
Yotin says. Kor grabbed Devon. Ashwin dove in to find him. Yotin pales and shouts to the troops behind us.
The prince is in the lake! Find him! Get him out before he's dragged through the gate!
Aquifers splash into the water up to their knees. The rest of the troops crowd along the shore and call their god by name. Anu, god of storms. Ki, mother of the mountains. Anlil, keeper of the flame. Anki, bearer of the seas. Why are they praying? They should be jumping into the lake. They should be looking for Devon. The stars blink into brightness, and the moon reveals its haunting eye. But their reappearance brings no joy. How dare the stars shine without him? How can they return when he is gone? How can the world be saved when my heart is destroyed? The mournful praying continues, and so does my raging at the heavens. Anu, you cannot! Devon is good! Kor cannot have him! A wave crashes nearby.
I have him!
Admiral Rimba shouts. Which one? I compel my eyes to open. A man lies on the ground, soldiers crowded around him. I try to sit up, but the abrupt movement rips my strength away. Numbness steals over me. Is it Devon? Please, Anu, for all that is good in the world, you must bring him back. A voice calls my name. I cannot tell whose. My spirit succumbs to the venom, and I float off into the night, seething at the stars. 34. Kalinda. The Tigris Pavilion is warm today. Spring awakens heat from the afternoon, and a breeze ushers in a sweetness scented of blooming irises and sun-warmed citrus. None of the women or girls complain, of course. We are content with the sunshine, remembering vividly a world under a broken sky. I have finished my art lesson and dismissed my class. Sarita, my co-instructor, will come by later to pack up my supplies and return them to my chamber. She has an aptitude for painting, and as I may never sketch like I used to, she is a fine asset. In the center of the pavilion, Parisa and Ashana demonstrate sparring strategies. Their class of temple wards sits cross-legged in front of the full weapon racks, their attention rapt on the Rani's wielding staffs. Near the black-and-white tiled fountain, Shyla shushes three girls for whispering instead of listening, and then lectures them on the importance of honoring the land goddess Ki and her sister warriors. Rian toddles at her feet, her little hands clinging to her mother's knees. Priestess Mita, healer Baka, Sister Hetal, and all the other sisters kneel on floor cushions in the shade of a ruby-red canopy. They sip on chilled mint and lemon tea and select ice chips from a bucket to suck on or wipe across their brows. Natasha suggested the wards and sisters stay at the palace until another temple could be built. Construction may not begin for a long while, though, as benefactors are reluctant to contribute to our collection now that we have altered the terms of the claiming. Some of them like the challenge of winning over a sister warrior, while others believe it is improper for women to select their occupation, and, should they desire, a husband. Regardless, the land goddess Ki always intended for women to have a choice. And so they will. Eventually, we will collect enough funds to erect the first sisterhood temple in Vani. But I already lament the day when these girls will leave us. They have been a pleasant distraction. Parisa's voice carries across the pavilion. We should always be kind to our sisters, she advises her pupils. Unless we're sparring, Ishana replies, bopping Parisa on the hip with her staff. Their class giggles as the pair exchange a series of light, playful whacks. I slink by the row of girls, waving goodbye to the few who also attend my art course, and slip out. In the corridor, I maneuver past men working high above on scaffolding. They spread white plaster across the wall and ceiling, patching holes and cracks in the ivory facade. Repairs on the palace began as soon as we returned to Vani. Well, almost immediately. First, we banished the rebels to the Arctic tundra. Anjali and the rest of Hostin's followers were commanded never to set foot in Tarachand again. Given their gross offenses, their punishment was a mercy. Then we helped our refugees relocate to their homes in Vani. The city is still partly empty, but more and more people return every day. I stride through to the center of the palace. The gate to the Raja's private atrium hangs open. I start down the path of the well-tended garden, alive with leafy trees and brightly colored flowers, and pause before I step on a fallen lime. I pick up the ripe citrus with my left hand, my only hand. Inda had to amputate my other one. She told me afterward that demon venom is deadlier than a dragon cobra's, which can kill a man in 15 minutes and an elephant in a few hours. Pons crafted me a prosthesis out of wood and leather, but I returned it to him so he could improve the cuff and strap. It fell off while I was teaching my art study. None of my students laughed. They have more respect for me than that. But I will not wear that hand again until it fits right. Through the shady trees, Natesha and Yatin bustle about. Brock, Madura, and Chit help them set up for tonight's feast in celebration of the arrival of Princess Jenny and Datu Bulon, as well as Chief Naresh and Tinley. The lot of them flew in this morning. This is our first reunion since we left Samia. I was in terrible shape that day. I spent the entire flight back to Vani holed up in my cabin on the chief's airship, refusing to see anyone except Inda for my healing sessions. Some days I wish I had never left that cabin. Setting down the lime, I back out of the atrium before my friends see me and invite me in. I ascend the staircase down to the main entry hall. Before I make it out the main palace door, Inda calls to me. She and Pons catch up, their bundled newborn cradled in his big arms. "How was your visit with your father yesterday?" I ask Inda. "Admiral Rimba and his wife came ahead of the Datu and Princess to spend more time with their daughter and grandchild." "Better," Inda says, leading us to an alcove off the entry. Whenever he's grumpy, I pass him the baby. Little by little, he'll accept our new family. I heard the Admiral's fit of temper while aboard the airship. He was none too happy about his daughter expecting a child out of wedlock, which evidently was more shameful to him than what Pons would experience from most Janardanians. Natesha told me later that he tried to wed Inda and Pons right then, in the air somewhere over northern Tarachand. But Inda would not allow her father to pressure her into a life-changing commitment like marriage before she was ready. The three of us, or four, including the baby, enter the hushed chapel. Burnt offerings lie in ash on the stone altar, the scent of sandalwood in the air. The chapel has rarely been empty since our return. Natesha and I burn sacrifices every day for those who perished on the mountaintop. I spend more time here than I do in my bedchamber. Pons holds their swaddled infant out for me to see. I peer down at her. She's already growing. She's 12 days old and you haven't held her yet, Inda replies. Oh, I don't think. Inda extracts her daughter from Pons's arms and places her in mine, and then pauses to see how I do with just one hand. I cuddle the sleeping baby snugly. Have you decided on a name yet? We chose Pons's mother's name, Jala. For a moment, I thought Inda said Jaya. Pons and I discussed it. We'd like you to be Jala's godmother. I never told you, but when I was carrying Jala, I felt at peace around you. Perhaps that's why I took to you, despite our being competitors. Odd as it may be, my feelings strengthened as Jala grew. Even seeing her with you now feels right. Look how happy she is.
It's as though she recognizes you. Tears burn behind my nose. I cannot say if this little soul is Jaya come to her next life, or her contentment with me is Inda's imagination. But holding Jala does feel right. Nothing remains of the Samia temple, but this little girl, she feels like home.
Will you accept?
Pons asks. Of course. Although they both forgave me for parching Inda, I have still wondered if such a violation could or should ever be forgiven. Their entrusting me with Jala's welfare rids the last of my doubts, and I promise myself never to question them again. The supper gong rings. Inda reaches for Jala and I pass her to her mother. I will not wait another 12 days before I hold her again. After I slip an incense stick into my pocket, I trail them out of the chapel. Are you coming to the feast? Inda asks. I have something I need to do. I pretend not to notice her and Pons's frowns. Inda gentles her tone. Kalinda, you need to try to move on. At some point, all my friends have given me this advice, but they do not tell me what I should move on to. They just want to push me over a cliff and see where I land. Thank you for letting me hold Jala, I say, and then resume my path out the front entry. Palm fronds rustle beneath a quiet dusk. The palace gardens, recently restored to their pre-war grandeur, are empty. Everyone is gathering for the feast. Natasha will spoil our guests with decadent dishes and desserts. She even arranged for dancers with bells on their ankles and wrists. My absence will disappoint them, but this is a happy occasion, and I cannot bring myself to fake a smile tonight. My mother's tomb lies between the two eucalyptus trees on a pathway lined with sweet and fruity-scented marigolds. My fingers tremble as I trace the newly carved names on the door beneath hers. Kishan Zacharias. General Devon Naik. I skim the rough imprint of Devon's name but feel only emptiness, as if the tomb were made of his body. When I awoke on the airship on the flight home from Samia, my first question was who? Who washed ashore? Inda told me the aquifers brought back Ashwin, and then ice reformed over the lake, sealing off the gate. But I cannot accept that Devon is gone. Pressing my palm over his name, I loiter on the threshold of the dead. The shadows around me deepen from dusky hues to inky velvet. I inhale their dewy scent. Nighttime has become my haven. I can be myself in the dark. An awareness prickles up my arms. Someone is watching me. Maybe it is wishful thinking, yet I strain to see through the shadows.
I like that you still wear trousers,
Ashwin says from behind me. The sensation of being watched passes as I turn toward him. You're late to the feast.
As are you.
He shoves his hands in his trouser pockets. He is dressed in his finery for supper, a gold-embroidered scarlet tunic jacket with a stand-up collar and matching turban.
Everyone is having a grand time. Chit offered to train Brock for his position. I want him for my Buddha ambassador.
He'll be perfect, I say. Brock will ensure that all Buddhas feel welcome in Tarachand, but also keep them in line. Recent squabbles have raised questions about how to enforce laws for those who misuse their powers. Buddha children, especially, need proper rearing and training. I am certain that Brock's first assignment will be to create a fair solution. Ashwin swings his shoulders casually, searching for something else to say.
Natasha and Yatin asked to hold their wedding here.
I do not believe his nonchalance. They asked, or you offered?
I may have suggested it. They don't have much means, what with their inn opening soon.
Ashwin plucks a bloom from the neem tree and twirls it in his hand.
It's odd to plan a wedding that isn't mine. I've chosen 4 virtue guards but cannot commit to a single bride. The Ranis and courtesans are growing restless waiting. I told them they can all stay. But there's only one name I wish to announce as my kindred.
Ashwin,
I say tiredly. It's time that I step aside and let there be another.
If the role of the kindred is unappealing, be my second or third wife.
You know I cannot. My duty to the throne ended when I vanquished Kor. I'll serve as your burner virtue guard. Though you really should choose one with two hands. He sobers some.
How was your sketching coming along?
Slowly. I have sketched every day since returning to the palace, and have shown improvement. But my poor drawings are not much to boast about. Ask Jemmy to marry you, Ashwin. She'll be a good wife, and your union will strengthen foreign ties. And as an heir, Jemmy will understand Ashwin's need to place the empire first, above even her.
You've thought through all the advantages,
he says, tossing the flower aside. You know I'm right, I reply in kind. It's time for you to marry. The Empire needs Ramis, and you're ready. Ashwin skims his finger across my cheek.
I wish it could be you.
You'll always place the Empire first, that's how it should be. But I have a different dream for myself. My attention strays to the shadows, to the sandalwood incense in my pocket, to the sketch in my bedchamber that I have been working on for a fortnight. Ashwin takes my hand in his.
If you ever change your mind.
Thank you. I squeeze his fingers lightly. He releases me without any more provocation.
Are you certain you won't join us? Yatin's older sisters are going to recite tales of the gods.
That does sound divine, but I really am tired. This is my customary excuse to reduce his disappointment in my absence or lack of interest about the happenings in the palace. Please send our guests my regards.
I will.
Ashwin tucks his hands in his trouser pockets and strolls off. I pick up the bloom he dropped and lay it in front of the tomb. Good night, Mother and Father. By the time I return inside, the lamps are lit, and the aroma of rich spices from the feast permeates the corridors. The balcony doors in my bedchamber are closed, the room stifling. Asha has been busy as of late. She is apprenticing to become a healer under Baka. I kick off my sandals and open the exterior doors. A wind ripples the draperies. I remember a time when Devon and I cocooned inside them, tangled up and... I stop myself before I cannot breathe, and I return to my bedchamber. Parchment and charcoal sketches are spread out across my table. I light the lamp, casting a glow over the sketch on top. An intriguing portrayal, mostly finished, stares up at me. His angular jaw that I have grazed, sweeping cheekbones that I have cupped, full lips that I have kissed, and kind, resolute eyes. His nose still is not straight. My left hand struggles with the evenness of the charcoal strokes that my right hand could once perform so deftly. It took me nearly 3 days to replicate the thickness of his eyelashes. But the effort must be put in. The sketch will be of no use until his nose is correct. I sit and try once more. Tiny trembles shake my left hand. The first line is wrong. I rub it clean and try once more. Then again, and again. The oil lamp burns low. The moon rises high, and the far-off noises from the feast quiet. Charcoal stains my fingers and nails, and my back aches from hunching over. When I am certain I will never draw a perfect line again, I finally do it. I draw the straight slope of his nose, and there he is, in all his perfection. My nerves spark, revitalizing my purpose. I have done it. I am ready. I take out the sandalwood incense I pocketed from the chapel. My fingertip glows with fire and I ignite the end. A steady flow of smoke rises, hazing the chamber and treating my senses to a smell I have missed. The sketch I toiled over for many days is laid on the table. Several moons worth of preparation and practice to regain a level of artistry with my weaker hand waits for me. Is it good enough? Does it look like him, or have I forgotten any details? The thought sets me ill at ease. I pick up the sketch and examine it, racking my memory. Each detail required painstaking care. No, I haven't missed anything. This is him. But if I am wrong, if I fail... My nerves cannot handle another moment of wavering. I blow out the lantern and shadows fall in around me. Pressing the sketch over my thudding heart, I survey the darkest corner of my chamber. Inhaling the sandalwood scent, I welcome the shadows, for they are the door to the Evernight. Anu, please let this be. Closing my eyes, I go deep into my mind and unlock my chest of treasures. Memories of Devon Naik, alive and whole, fill me. His deep chuckle, satiny kiss, and soft beard. I continue the trail of memories, going back to the first time I saw him atop his horse, riding toward the temple. I hone my senses, seeking for a change in the dark, and open my eyes. No one is here. I expand my sense of awareness, seeking a presence in my dim room, but grasp onto nothing. Names hold power. I call to him, first with my mind and heart, and then with my lips. Devon Naik. The shadows do not stir. I am speaking to myself, to a ghost, to a lost dream. The tears come, though I scarcely feel them. They are so prevalent as of late, especially at night when I am alone. I set down the sketch and put out the incense. Moonlight frosts my balcony. I shut the doors, deepening the shadows in my chamber, and trudge to my bed. Tears fill up my nose and throat. I always think they will drown me, but they never do. I drop onto the mound of frivolous pillows, though I have found one use for them. Selecting a square one, I press it over my face and release a sob. Natasha sometimes checks on me at night, and I do not want her to hear me. I weep into the satin cloth until my head swims with a headache. Tossing it aside, I wipe at my soggy nose, and a sudden awareness passes over me. Someone is here. I capture my breath and slowly sit up. A shadow of a man stands near the empty hearth. I gasp, my lips trembling. I can hardly exhale as he crosses to me. At the side of my bed, I push up and lift my fingers to his profile, the one I sketched this evening and dream of each night. "Kali," Devon says, at the same moment I touch his cheek. He is real, not a pillar of dark. He pulses soul fire. "You came. You found me." I leap at him and his arms lock around me, solid and strong. He is a real man. I grab him close as can be, terrified that if I let go, he will disappear. "I knew you were alive. I looked for you in the shadows." He buries his face in my hair. "I tried to come before, but the dark made it difficult. There are so many pathways to take. I felt you stronger tonight. You were like a beacon." I lean back and cup his bearded chin. His serious eyes are the same rich brown. Though his hair is longer, the shaggy length frames and softens his stern jaw. He smells of his normal sandalwood, tagged on by a hint of mist. "You're trapped in the Evernight?"
"Yes."
I run my hand down to his chest. His heart thuds regularly against my palm. "Does it hurt? Are you in pain?" He strokes my hair.
"It's dark. But I'm all right."
"I have to get you out of there. I know of a tale. Inanna's descent. She saved her intended from death. She went down into the void and found him. I can use my powers to come for you." I push a glow into my hand and he starts to fade from view. I pull back on my soul fire, and a frustrated groan lodges in my throat. He is confined to shadows, unable to come into the light. "Do not cry. He doesn't need your weeping." But as I gaze at Devon once more, his soul fire feels wrong, like a flame trapped behind glass. "I'm so sorry. I should have done more, gone back in the lake after you or made the others on shore search harder and longer." My tears squeeze past my restraint.
I tried, I did.
He rests his forehead against mine.
When I went through the